Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict. The headlines from London. Britain ramps up naval support for Ukraine to, quote, keep Kyiv in the fight. And Starmer, the leader of the opposition, calls Russia, quote, a real and constant threat. And Putin boasts Russia has upgraded entire nuclear arsenal as he goads West over Ukraine, quote, failures. And Zelensky pushes back on the Ukrainian army request for 500,000 more soldiers. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft to comment on these headlines and more, because we are at end of year, third winter of war. At the same time, it is obvious there is a hesitation in the United States. There is a hesitation in Europe for a third year of war. To what end? What is the mission? Anatole, a very good evening to you. A colleague of yours, a distinguished columnist, Simon Cooper, has published in the Financial Times what follows from a surrender, an armistice, a stand down from opposing the Russian aggression in Ukraine, and what would follow. And he has several points here that are nightmares, but at the same time, not out of bounds. And I welcome your comments. One is the scariest. Russia exacts terrible victor's justice, meaning mass executions and war crimes against the Ukrainian people. He puts that in front of a European audience that, from the commentary responding to Mr. Kupfer's column, that does not seem to frighten Europe whatsoever. Where are we in European opinion, Britain opinion and European opinion about Ukraine war? Are they ready to live with a partitioned Ukraine despite the threat of Russia becoming even more aggressive towards the Ukrainian people or towards the rest of Europe? Good evening to you.
Hello, John. I have to say I found Simon's piece pretty over the top. Undoubtedly, if Russia conquers more areas of Ukraine, it will carry out repression against people it regards as too pro-Ukrainian. But the accounts of Russian atrocities last year, the Russian denial that they occurred is nonsense, but the Western reporting has hugely exaggerated them. I looked into this when I was in Ukraine in the spring, and I'm sorry to say that a lot of this was pretty much par for the course in a counterinsurgency. There was, for example, and also to some extent par for the course in war, their rapes undoubtedly occurred, but there was no campaign of mass rape. The executions were of in general in Bucha, north of Kiev, of people the Russians suspected, often it must be said with good reason, of passing intelligence to the Ukrainian forces to target the Russians. When it came to civilian casualties, it was extremely difficult to unpick who had been deliberately shot, who had been killed in bombardments, and of the people killed in bombardments, how many had been killed by Russian bombardment and how many had been killed by Ukrainian bombardment, remembering that the towns I visited had been under Russian occupation in the first weeks of the war, and so the Russians were not bombarding their own positions. So this is a kind of, narrative of barbarism, which, you can turn round pretty much, I have to say, against any country that has been at war. This leaves aside, of course, the question of the justification for the war in the first place, which is a quite different matter. As to the whole question of defeat and victory, in Ukraine and how far this would embolden Russia. Well, as you know, more and more people are asking, including in the US Senate, but also in Europe, it all depends on what you mean by victory and defeat. Because given Ukraine's, I mean, very understandable, but now it looks unachievable goal of driving Russia from all the territory that it has held since 2014, that, of course, would be complete victory for Ukraine. But given, you know, what Russian hopes were or Putin's hopes were at the start of the war, which was to subjugate the whole of Ukraine, and then the second stage was to conquer much bigger areas of Ukraine, holding Russia to, since last year, to, you know, a pretty small sliver of southeastern Ukraine with not even the provincial capitals and main cities of the provinces that it has claimed since last year, you know, could be called a very substantial Ukrainian victory. And also in terms of the history of the past 300 years, after all, if 80% of Ukraine can remain independent and, you know, move towards the West, that is a colossal historical victory for Ukraine. But where I do agree with Simon is that the crucial question for the future will be Ukraine moving towards membership of the European Union. But of course, whatever Brussels may say, that process cannot begin while the war continues. And that's not just because of the economic destruction and the huge numbers of refugees. It's also because the internal measures that Ukraine itself has implemented, or Zelensky has, once again, I mean, very understandable in the context of war. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, he barred the former president, Poroshenko, who nobody, by the way, can possibly accuse of being pro-Russian, from leaving the country. And there is, you know, and once again, very understandably, they are at war, but a considerable measure of domestic repression in Ukraine. That will continue as long as the war goes on. It has to. I'm not blaming the Ukrainians for this. But this, of course, is quite incompatible with what are supposed to be the internal rules of the European Union. And, you know, I think in America, people have a tendency to forget that, you know, joining NATO is basically pretty easy. I mean, Turkey has been, you know, a member of NATO virtually since the beginning, although for extensive periods, including in many ways today, Turkey was hardly a Western democracy or a developed economy, though it is now. The European Union is quite different. You have to sign up to literally thousands of detailed clauses about, you know, your economic rules, your political system. And we've also, of course, seen in the reaction of Polish and East European farmers and now Polish and East European truckers that even some of, you know, Ukraine's closest allies in the West can become very unfriendly when it's a question of, you know, concrete economic harm to them. So the whole path to European Union membership is very complex, and once again can't begin until the war is over.
Simon Cooper, this is a column in the Financial Times. I recommend everyone look at it because he's entertaining worst-case scenarios. One of the possible consequences, he notes, is that the success of the Kremlin in Ukraine would encourage China, Venezuela, Azerbaijan, and Russia again to use annexation to gain political favor or military advantage, especially China, given the constant threat against Taiwan. Is that a concern of everyone's, that a defeat, a loss, a frozen conflict in Ukraine will encourage China?
Well, I mean, a continuing conflict in Ukraine to some extent helps China by, of course, distracting American attention. But that could be called, and resources, but that, of course, could equally well be turned around into an argument for ending the war in Ukraine. I mean, on the other hand, of course, the war in Ukraine and Western sanctions have, and now, of course, what's happening in the Middle East and the Red Sea has really driven up oil prices, which is certainly not a good thing for the Chinese economy, since they are massive importers of oil. But, you know, I don't really buy this notion that everything in the world depends on everything else. And, you know, that if the West suffers a limited defeat in one part of the world, everywhere else will start to collapse. This used to be known as the domino theory at the time of Vietnam. You know, if the US abandons southern Vietnam, communism, you know, will then spread to take over Thailand and then India. And this, of course, proved to be absolute nonsense. In Europe, for example, the core American interests and Western interests lie in the integrity of NATO and the European Union, of which Ukraine is not currently a member. I mean, of course, the United States has to make clear its complete continued commitment to NATO. But as long as that is the case, look, I mean, if the Soviet Union didn't attack NATO during the Cold War when it had massive conventional advantages, the infinitely weaker Russia of today is hardly likely to do so. And as for Venezuela, I mean, you know, please, Venezuela, if Venezuela goes to war with its neighbors, I mean, there are many hawks in Washington who would absolutely love that, because America, of course, would crush it immediately put in a pro-American government. As for Taiwan, the Chinese will calculate based on the military balance in the Eastern Pacific and whether the status quo, which is, no recognition of Taiwanese independence, can be maintained. But these are neither things that, whether the U.S. is willing to maintain the status quo. These are not things that depend on the war in Ukraine.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We're using as our text a column by Simon Cooper of the Financial Times, a distinguished columnist who lives in continental Europe. And when we come back, what about NATO and EU? Anatole mentions them. What would they look like after a frozen conflict, surrender, stand down, armistice in Ukraine? I'm John Batchelor.